Is English a second language for you? Are you required to take a test to prove your proficiency in English? Are you considering the IELTS and worried that you can't get that competitive score? Worry no more. Listen to today's podcast where I speak with an IELTS master. Welcome to the 319th episode of Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target programs and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result, you get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in," and not only in, but in at the best program for you. The featured resource for today's show is Fitting In and Standing Out, the paradox at the heart of admissions. Your application needs to show that you will do both, and that's a tough challenge. Master that paradox, and you are well on your way to acceptance. Download this free guide at accepted.com/FISO. Again, that's accepted.com/FISO, as in fitting in and standing out. Our guest today is Ben Worthington. Now, Ben hails from Northern England, but has lived in different parts of the globe. In 2006, he started teaching English as a second language. In 2012, he launched the IELTS podcast to help students ace that exam. Today, the IELTS podcast provides free resources and three different levels of paid courses. Let's learn more about the IELTS podcast and get some expert tips on how to succeed at an exam that's critical if you're applying to English language universities and graduate programs and you're worried that English fluency, or the lack of it, could prevent your acceptance. Ben, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Hello there, Linda. It's great to be here. And yeah, I'm quite excited about this interview.
Good. Thank you. How did you get into IELTS prep?
Well, I used to be an English tutor back in Spain. I did my Erasmus, which was like an exchange program. And then after that, I decided to stay. And I kind of like drifted into teaching English in Spain. Mm-hmm. And I started off like just doing, you know, like maybe some classes with teenagers.
Ooh, that
maybe
must have been doing tough.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And especially Spanish ones, because those Spanish children, they're so lively, but then the teenagers, it's kind of this mixture of, I don't know, it was quite a challenge. All this energy had kind of gone and it kind of directed to the opposite, you know, like most teenagers. So it's kind of like, it was hard work. And then I was doing business students as well, but eventually I kind of like found my niche, which was IELTS. And yeah, I just found that I really enjoyed preparing students for that. You know, it was more of a challenge. There's more motivated students. So it was a good match.
Can you give us an overview of the IELTS exam? Just what is it?
Right. Well, the IELTS exam stands for the International English Language Testing System, right? And this was developed originally, I think, is in Australia. It's called the Davis exam. This was like in the 70s, just to test students' English abilities. And then the British Council got involved and it became the IELTS test. That's what it kind of like morphed into. And yeah, now it's used as, well, not only for getting into university in Australia, UK, Canada, it's also started to be more accepted in the US. Traditionally, I think it was TOEFL that had it. Yes. Now you can use it not only for the universities, but also on your visa applications as well.
Yeah. And how is it structured? Like, what are the different parts of the exam?
Gotcha. Right. Well, there's four parts: speaking, listening, reading, and writing. And
covers it.
And the listening and the reading both have, like, you can get between 0 and 40 points an offer. And from each section, you can get between a band 0 and a band 9. And the way they do this for this reading and for the listening, you take the test and then there's like 40 questions there. And you could go through and you're like you're ticking the boxes or you're completing the sentence or you're doing a multiple choice. And then that equates to a band score after you've done those tests. And then with the speaking and with the writing, it's marked by an examiner.
And so is it a human examiner or is it like virtual like we're doing or a video?
Exactly. Well, it's for the speaking, you are in front of another person, the examiner. And that examiner has to, basically, there's like three parts for the speaking, part one, part two, part three. And part one are kind of like softer questions with the idea of just to get the student relaxed and make them feel okay. And so that they can give the best demonstration of their ability. And then goes on to part two, where you get a cue card, where you can choose from three cue cards. And on each of those cue cards, it might just be a question like, describe your childhood friend, describe where you met this person, why you like this person, and any fond memories, or something like that, yeah? And then you've got about, 2 minutes to prepare your talk, and then you talk about all the points on that cue card, and then after that the examiner is going to do some follow-on questions, which is part three, and those be questions like, why do you think friendship is important?
It's much more theoretical.
Exactly, like more abstract, the student to really develop their answers. So yeah, that's for the speaking, and then for the writing, there's the general test or the academic test. And for the general, for task one, you have to write a letter, and this letter is, it can be maybe a letter of complaint, it could be a letter for a job, it could be a letter to a friend, and then you've got to basically choose the right register so you can make it very formal. Or quite informal, just depending on the task that's set. And then there's part two, which I think is the misery of every IELTS student, because it really is one of the most challenging parts. And then for part two, it's a question that's a little bit more, it might be a question about democracy, it might be a question about environmentalism or climate change. And the student has to maybe take a side argue both sides. And that can be a real challenge. And then just one last thing, for task one of the academic, because task two is the same for both the general and the academic, task two is the same for both, but for task one, it's different. Task one for the general is the letter, and then task one for the academic, you have to describe a graphic. So it might be a bar chart, might be some pie chart, might be a flow chart, might be a process, and you have to describe that.
It's testing more than just English, actually. I mean, English fluency. It's more than that.
Yeah. Well, this is a very interesting point. And a lot of students do complain about this. And what I found amazing when I got into this was that even native English speakers can get low scores on this. And really? That just shows what you just said.
They're testing reasoning and skills and interpretive skills. If you're given a graph and asked to interpret it, that's not really... That's a visual kind of skill, not necessarily English fluency. Obviously,
absolutely, yeah. These are like the exam skills, and like the ability to write a coherent paragraph, yes. The ability to sort of like communicate and articulate your argument in a persuasive manner. All of these skills is kind of go a bit beyond the language part of it.
Like you say, maybe native English speakers wouldn't do so well on it, or perhaps the same people in their native language wouldn't be able to do so well.
Exactly. Yeah. So the difficulty is like
fluency.
Yeah, it's the difficulty is really compounded for a non-native English speaker because, like you said, they'll possibly have problems in their own language doing the same task. Yeah, good point.
Now, I know for some graduate programs, people have a choice between the TOEFL, the IELTS, and the PTE, which I believe is the Pearson's Test of English, right?
Pearson, I think, maybe.
Pearson, you're right. You're right. Pearson Test of English. If you have a choice, how does an applicant or prospective test taker choose which one to take? What would you advise that person?
This is quite interesting, actually. I'd honestly, I know I should say IELTS because this is what I should be saying. But I would honestly maybe do some practice tests in each one, you know, and then go for the one that kind of resonates with you the most. Maybe you've got no problem speaking with a human in front of you, you know, with the IELTS. And maybe you're going to shine more and even perform better with an examiner in front of you. But for other students, that could be really horrible and they might prefer to do it the TOEFL way, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'd really recommend just doing practice tests for each one and doing your research and then just finding out which you're the most comfortable with, you know?
That makes a lot of sense. Thanks for the great advice. Now, you know, they all have different methods of scoring. And I hear a lot about, and you mentioned briefly, band this, band that. What is generally considered a good band?
Right. Well, I mean,
what does it matter? I mean, does it matter depend upon the purpose that you're taking the exam for?
Yeah. Is that also relevant? Yeah. That's a big factor. And also, it kind of like shifts as well. You know, like generally speaking, most places are asking for around a 7. Yeah. Okay. Band 7. However, like if you're, I don't know, maybe Canada needs a lot of computer engineers, you know, they've realized that there's a shortage of computer engineers. And so they might just lower it a little bit until they can meet the quotas. You know, and maybe say, okay, instead of a band 8, we're going to go for a band, we're going to lower it to band 7 because we need to get these computer engineers in, you know. So, and also a really prestigious university can ask for maybe band 8s across the board. Wow. Yeah. Whereas a terrible university, not terrible, but maybe a less
lower
popular
ranked
university.
Yes. Okay. Less competitive.
Exactly, yeah. They might be more willing to get, I don't know, accept a 5.5, you know, a band 5.5 across the board, across the range. So it kind of really depends, but generally speaking, a 7 is what we see the most, and it's the most popular target band score.
And is it, can it be a 7.1? You mentioned 7.5. How does it break down?
It only breaks down into like halves. So you can have 7.5 or 9, 8.5 and 8, and, you know, so on and so forth.
Do people from particular parts of the world, different regions of the world, do you see like a trend, like certain people from certain parts of the world will have more problems with the speaking part or more problems with the writing part, or be particularly good on, I don't know, on... On reading, but not on writing. I mean, have you seen anything like that? Any patterns like that?
Well, I can give you sort of like two answers to that. There's sort of like what I've broadly seen, but I don't know if it's a bit of like stereotyping influencing what I'm saying here. But generally, like the countries that seem to be sort of like more open and more sort of like talkative, like our countries' cultures, like which are more open and more communicative, maybe like the Latino culture, the Spanish culture, Italian one, they don't seem to have that bigger issues with the speaking. Yeah. Whereas the cultures which are a little bit more reserved, especially in Asia, what I usually find is that they don't really excel at the speaking part because they're quite nervous about losing face and all of this. you know. And also interestingly, I think it was like about 2010, but they don't do it anymore. The IELTS organization, it released statistics about all the different countries that were, you know, which countries scored the highest and which countries scored the lowest. And the countries that scored the highest, like across the board for speaking, for writing, for reading, listening, were the countries that you would pretty much expect to score high. So we're talking about Scandinavia, Germany, the Netherlands, you know. And then the countries at the lower end were basically the sort of like lesser developed countries, the poorer ones, so, which is quite, you know, expected. So, yeah.
That makes, I mean, certainly the excellence of Germany or Northern Europe makes sense, because whenever I haven't done a lot of traveling in Northern Europe, but when I have, that the English of the man on the street is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think I remember my Spanish friends, they were really busting their gut to learn English. And I've just come back from Norway. And I told them a story, and I had to ask for directions. And I asked a tramp on the street for directions, and he replied in English to me. And then my Spanish friend Pedro here was just like, whoa, how did you understand him? And I was like, because he spoke in English. And he's like, wow, even the tramps speak English, you know. it's just so prevalent there. Yeah, it's insane.
How do you recommend, or I know how, obviously you have hundreds of videos, et cetera. So that's a kind of a broad question. How long do you recommend that IELTS test takers prepare for the exam? When should they start? Or does it depend on what they get on the practice exams? I assume that would be safe.
Well, I think it depends on the ability of the student, you know. If they're like a lot of, take the Northern Europe example, you know, like a Swedish student or a German student, maybe they're around a 6.5 already just because of like the secondary education and college education.
Yeah.
In that case, maybe they could get to a 7 in a month. They can jump that half a band score in a month just by getting familiar with the exam, starting adapting their writing into a more academic style. And for those students, 4 weeks, 3 weeks, you know, with the right kind of tuition. But if the student is just scraping a 6 or around a 6.5 and they want to get to a 7, then I would probably say maybe 2 months or 3 months. Well, it kind of goes back to what we were saying before. You know, if the student has to build language skills, then we're talking, I would say, maybe 2 months, 3 months. But also, again, it depends on the intensity that they're studying in those 2 or 3 months. Generally speaking, if the student wants to improve their language skills, I would usually say maybe 2 or 3 months for half a band score or a full band score. But if it's the exam skills, those can be learned much quicker, you know, and that's a much shorter time frame in that case.
Okay. What is the IELTS podcast? Tell us a little bit about that. How did you come to start it, and what does it offer to test takers?
Right. Well,
you started it pretty early in the podcast history.
Yeah, I think I'm granddad in this podcast industry. I started by interviewing a lot of other tutors and ex-IELTS examiners because I was struggling a little bit when I started getting into this, you know, and I was listening to a lot of podcasts myself. And so I was like, okay, I can get the experts on and I'm going to rack their brains. And I can keep on learning, and I'm going to improve myself. I'm going to help a lot of students as well. So I got experts onto the program. We started asking them, you know, like common areas where students fall, or sometimes we get like a pronunciation expert on, or an IELTS examiner on, someone who's sort of like real specific body of knowledge that they could share. We started doing interviews, and then eventually I started doing my own sort of like episodes where I'll just talk about paragraphing or maybe punctuation or something like that. Just a real sort of like focused 30-minute tutorial. And Yeah, so it's kind of just grown from there. And then since then, we expanded and got the, you know, essay correction service. We got the YouTube channel. And it's just keeps growing each year. So it's quite exciting. Yeah, it's started off as my baby. And it's, as I said, I'm the granddad now. And this is the, it's my baby. So, yeah, soon it's going to be a teenager. So, yeah, it's been around a while.
What are the courses that you offer? You have IELTS podcast. You also have the IELTS podcast courses, right?
Yeah. Well, we started off just doing like essay correction, you know, and that was, we started doing the normal corrections, and then it kind of evolved into a PDF because I started giving them sort of like, take this PDF. It's got everything that I was saying. And it kind of grew from there. So we really built out the writing course because of all the corrections we were doing. It just seemed like the logical thing just to, because we kept on repeating ourselves. And yeah. I was like, all right, let's just put this in some tutorials and develop some exercises around it. So yeah, the main course is the writing one. And that includes essay corrections and comes with a guarantee as well of a jump to a band 7 or it's free. So it's quite a strong guarantee. And yeah, and we can do that because we've just been correcting so many essays. There's a team of us now. So the main course is the writing. And then there's also the speaking confidence one and the reading. And I haven't really developed the listening one because the reason is because I honestly believe that it's not really necessary. I think a student can do practice exam after practice exam, you know. I give them some tips, but that's really something that I didn't honestly feel necessary to build a course for that. And maybe I should do, but I honestly believe that a student can really develop, prepare for that exam on by themselves, you know.
And do you have free resources available for the parts of the exam that, let's say, aren't appropriate for the course?
Well, if they go to IELTS podcast/sign, there's a big jumbo PDF that they can download, which is
like SIGN sign.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay. And there it's just full of model sample essays. It's full of tips. It's full of preparation strategies and sample questions, and it's just like a big jumbo resource there. I think there's some discount coupons in there as well, and so they can use that just to get started. And also I'd recommend getting on the email list, because there we just like emailing tips out every couple of days and new episodes. And yeah, there's quite a lot of value in that, actually. It took a while to develop the whole series.
I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure. Well, we'll link to IELTSpodcast.sign and from the show notes, which will be at accepted.com/319. You can go to either one and end up at the same place. Now, can you just give us a few tips right now for the IELTS exam? Your top favorite tips.
Right then, well, my favorite one, and this is because it's like one of the most effective ones, is that to maximize your preparation time, you really need to find out where you're losing points. So not only for the reading and the listening, but for the speaking and for the writing. For example, with the reading, and we don't just sort of like say, okay, reading is my weakest point. I need to develop the reading. That's a good place to start, but we can go a little bit more. Like we can zoom in. We take a test and we're like, okay, I've done 3 tests now and I can see that I'm constantly losing points on sentence completion, you know? So now you just do sentence completion exercises until you bring that up to scratch, until you bring that up to the target score that you want to. And you can do exactly the same with the reading. You can do exactly the same with the writing. But with the writing, the fastest way to improve is to get some feedback. And you write your essay, you get some feedback, and you'll see that, okay, I'm always making a mistake with articles. Yeah? So go and get the grammar book. Go and do some online exercises. really work on this. And a lot of students, sometimes they just kind of send essay after essay after essay. And it's like, okay, that's not going to work. You really need to sit down, put some active, focused energy into just mastering this one little micro point of the English language or the test. Yeah. And really just focus on building your capability with the use of articles, you know, and online tests and stuff like that, online quizzes, and then write another essay. And also, when you finish writing that essay, self-check it. Look for mistakes that you've made in the past, you know. And this way, when you hand it into the person who's correcting it, they're going to be able to, it's going to take them less time to correct it, so they can spend more time giving you some helpful advice on how to improve it. And personally, I love tutoring students on how to improve their essay rather than just correcting it. You know, saying this is wrong, this is wrong, this is right. I'd much rather be saying, okay, this is good. We can really impress the examiner if right. we use this term. You know, I think it's more enjoyable for the student as well.
Sure. So if I can summarize, what you're basically saying is try and learn from your mistakes.
Pretty much.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't mean to be funny here.
No.
But because I know that sometimes applicants just beat themselves up about their mistakes, which doesn't mean that they learn from them. They just beat themselves up. Other times applicants will focus on what they did right, what they're proud of. Well, that's very good. It's good. Give yourself a pat on the back. But you really need to improve over here where it wasn't so good. And you need to learn from it, practice it again, and move up in the process.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really important point. That, and when we're doing the corrections, we always try and focus on sort of like the good parts as well that the student's done well. And
it's like you said, you can learn from that also.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's so sad that a lot of correction services are just pointing out the errors, you know, just pointing out the mistakes. And because what might be a perfect construction in English will just seem normal for an English speaker. You know, it won't be anything special, like you did a sentence, big wow, you know. But and it's such a shame because the student could have poured a lot of like sweat, tears and energy into this, and it just goes in a mess. So yeah, but it is a case of learning from your mistakes. And there's a super point what you said about just not beating yourself up about it and not focusing on just the errors. You know, give yourself credit for writing for doing the work and for just feedback and improvement and get on that positive cycle, improving your work. So yeah.
Now, I was watching one of your videos, and in the one that I saw, you distinguished between language skills and exam skills. And you kind of alluded to that, I think, earlier in our conversation. Can you dive into that distinction a little bit? And also, what is the implication of that distinction for exam prep?
Right then. Yeah. It kind of goes back to what we were saying before, like the native speaker, they can fail. So if we go to more detail, let's just focus on the writing. Yeah. A lot of students struggle with academic writing, and what they'll do is just kind of take this voice or take the conversation that's going on in their head and put it down on paper. So they'll be talking, so they'll be writing with contractions, and they'll be maybe using "I totally agree" instead of "I strongly agree." Or they might be using words like a lot of kids play football, whereas they should be really saying a lot of children play football. Yeah. And so it's these kind of little things that you'd never pay any attention to unless you were preparing for an exam. So this is why we have to really upgrade our language and stop using contractions, write up the full version. Start using formal language. Instead of saying "but," we say "however," and instead of saying "also," maybe we'll say "furthermore," and just these more formal way of communicating, just for the writing. This is just for the writing. So that's
where actually somebody who's fluent in English, even if, let's say, you're Northern Europeans, could actually do worse in the writing section because of their fluency.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And what happens is a lot of people, they'll come overconfident because they've got no issues in communicating what they want to say, like in a verbal way. And they'll think, oh, that's just going to translate to the written way. And it doesn't really work like that. But those are the kind of students, though, that who can usually communicate reasonably effectively with the speaking. They put it into writing, it's not that good. But those are the ones that once they learn the rules for writing for an exam, for formal academic writing, once they learn the rules, boom, you know, they're writing really amazing essays pretty quickly, you know, especially if they're on the right course and applying the right material. So yeah, that would be the difference between the exam skills and sort of like language skills for the writing. Also, you know, the ability to write a coherent, I mean, we've just focused on the granular than the actual writing style, but there's also the ability to communicate your point in a paragraph.
Yeah.
And to make a coherent argument that doesn't contradict itself, you know, and to make it crystal clear. And also there's just one other thing that I found, I see a lot of students struggling with, and that's that they'll come to the exam and they'll be thinking that they can write, they'll see a question and they'll write a really intelligent answer, yeah? But the examiner doesn't really care about the quality of the idea. It's a language exam at the end of the day, so we've got to be concerned with the quality of the communication, yeah? The quality of the way the idea is expressed. So I always say it's better to go for a basic idea that's expressed eloquently rather than a super amazing idea that's going to trip you up when you're trying to explain it. You know, the grammar's going to trip you up because it's terribly complex, but it's amazingly intelligent, but, you know, it's going to trip you up when you try and write it, and that's going to cost you points. So just play it safe and go for an idea that's easier to communicate, but expressed in a very formal academic way. So that would be with the writing. And then with the speaking, it's kind of a similar issue, you know. We can't go in there all casual. We've got to treat it like a job interview. We've got to learn special skills, like how can you talk for 2 minutes about your best friend, you know. Even native English language speakers are going to struggle with that. So there's all these kind of like little nuances and also, which I can't find kind of peculiar, is that some cultures, they're not used to like the small talk, you know, or they don't know where to put their eyes during the conversation.
Yeah.
And these kind of cultural issues as well, these are kind of more like exam skills.
Right. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting. I mean, again, as we discussed at the beginning of the podcast, it seems like some of what they're looking for are thinking skills more than fluency skills. And I don't know if that's an exam skill, or is that is probably an exam skill more than a language skill, or is it a third category?
Yeah, I think if you have one of those Venn diagrams, you know, there's probably a bit of overlap for both of them.
Yeah.
And it is, yeah, the thinking skill. I remember one tutor as well saying that, okay, the writing exam is a reading exam because you've got to really comprehend the question and then write an answer that's really focused on answering that question, you know? And the speaking exam is a listening exam, because if the examiner asks you, you know, where would you like to go for your dream holiday? And then you reply, I went on my dream holiday last year. You're not really answering the question. So this is why it's really important to develop these, like, you know, the listening skills for the speaking exam and the reading skills for the writing exam. But yeah, you're totally right with the, it's like thinking skills and also the confidence as well. You know, you've got to develop the confidence to go in there and, you know, show the examiner that you're quite a capable candidate, and thinking on your feet as well about questions that you might never have asked. And this is why I think confident students usually do better than the nervous students, you know?
Right, for sure. For sure. Mm-hmm. It's interesting also what you're saying. I mean, in general, from my experience, both working with clients and my own experiences learning a second language or studying a second language, it seemed like writing is the most difficult, the last stage of fluency. My parents were both immigrants and English was not their native language. And well into, you know, when I was an adult and they'd been in America for, you know, 30 years or something, they would still come to my sister and me and say, can you look at this? And I was really surprised. I was shocked because they spoke and wrote fluent English. Uh-huh. But there was that slight lack of confidence. The other thing that I find somewhat surprising is my father, who was multilingual, he spoke 7 or 8 languages.
Wow.
But yes, but he only studied English in Europe. And, you know, he came to the United States and he spoke a very formal English. It was a literary English. And even as an older man, when he wrote a letter, a business letter, it was full of these literary allusions and very formal. It wasn't stilted anymore. It was fluent and it was grammatically correct. Sometimes the sentence structure was a little tortured, but but it was, you know, it's the exact opposite of what you're saying. And I suspect that might be a sign of the times more than it could have been. It could just be my dad also. But, you know, when he was in school, people were more formal. Today, you know, everybody's chatting and on their phone and Twitter and social media, and it's much more casual. So I wonder if that's a little bit a reflection of the times.
Maybe the language is kind of, now it's everybody's reading and everybody's writing. But back in the past, it was exclusive.
And they're writing very casually.
You know, exactly. Yeah. Totally. And and writing with emojis as well.
God, just forget the words.
Imagine doing an IELTS.
With emojis, right?
I strongly agree. Thumbs up.
This is a lot of fun. I say, what would you have liked? We can go on this for a little bit. But what would you have liked me to ask you?
I'm still thinking of a formal essay now with emojis. You know, it's possible because over the last 2 years, they've been able to do IELTS on computer, you know? Yeah. And so for the first time in the history of this test, that you can go in and you can type your answer. And for a lot of students, this is an absolute boon because they've lost this, not lost, but not that many people are writing with a pen and paper anymore, you know?
Right.
And then you've got to write in another, you've got to write in another language and then in a formal way. So, I know for a fact that if I was doing any language test, I'd want it to be on the computer, you know?
My handwriting is terrible. I pity anybody who tries to read it. I type, I type for it to be legible.
Exactly. Yeah, mine is tiny as well, and I think I do it on purpose because my paranoid streak comes out. Tiny, so no one can see it. Okay, so a question. Yeah, actually, a question has just popped into my mind now. For preparing for the exam, I think. Give yourself time, give yourself time, because what I see so many times, and it's really saddening, is that a student will say, right, I'm going to take the exam, and I'm going to take it in the next 2 months, and I need to pass it, you know, so they'll put in for the exam, they can take it in 2 weeks' time, or I think it's even shorter now, and then they won't get the score they want, so they'll put in again, and again, and again. And they'll just carry on just pouring money like, oh, I didn't get it this time. I'll just give it another shot. You know, maybe I'll get lucky this time. But usually they don't. They get stuck on that, stuck at that 6.5. It's so common. So I think the best way is to give yourself time. And this way, because doing test after test after test, I call it the IELTS casino, you know, and just people, maybe I'll get the score that I want. Maybe I'll get that 7 this time.
It goes round and round, right?
Exactly, yeah. I'm going to put all my money on this one. But the thing is, it's like, I don't know, it's like $200, $300 per test, you know? And it's really the whole rigmarole of going to the test center, you know? Going to the test center, it's nerve-wracking, it's expensive, it's time-consuming, and then it's just like a slap around the face when you don't get the scores you want, but your immediate reaction is like, I'm going to put in and do it again and try it again. So they go through the ringer again and again and again. And I've heard students taking the test like 21 times.
Ouch. Yes.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But they get sort of like in this tunnel vision, whereas the much wiser and much more healthier way to do this for your mental health is to sort of like take a step back,
yes,
and just really sort of like sit down, do what I said before, like, right, where are my weak points? Where am I losing points? And I'm just going to work on this. And I'm not going to just do a 13-hour Sunday with 20 coffees and for the rest of the week do nothing, you know? What I'm going to do is like an hour a day every morning, the consistency, and really just sort of like put in the hours and sort of like be kind to myself, you know? I'm not going to like berate myself for doing 20 tests and failing all 20 of them. And we're just going to be easy on myself and just give myself the time and the patience and the space and the room to improve, you know, because it's going to be a much more enjoyable experience and more economical as well. So, yeah, that's I think that's probably what I wanted to say about that.
That's a great piece of advice. I know I get asked a lot, not so much about the IELTS in particular, but more about, you know, the GRE, the GMAT, the MCAT, the LSAT, which are the aptitude tests in the United States for graduate school. Should I retake? Should I retake? And if they're not satisfied with the score, I generally do encourage a retake, but I'll also ask them, what are you going to change this time?
Yeah.
If you're going to do the same thing and it didn't work last time, why do you think you're going to have a different score next time around?
Yeah, you know, fantastic.
And that goes back to your great point. Look at what you did well, build on that. Look at what you did poorly in, work on that, fix it, and then you'll change it. Then you'll have, you know, but you to just do what you did last time.
Exactly.
I expect a different result.
Exactly, yeah. And just like, oh, maybe I'll get lucky this time, you know? Maybe this is
going to
be
good. I think you're going to the casino. I think you're right.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so, then, no, I think it's a great point. Ben, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your taking the time to speak with me. Where can listeners and IELTS test takers learn more about the IELTS podcast and your courses?
They can go to IELTSpodcast.com.
That's a good one.
That's my creative branding in action. But, they can go to IELTSpodcast.com. And there's the essay correction service. There's the online course. And there's a ton of tutorials. Yeah, there's a ton of tutorials, and each tutorial usually has the audio podcast, the whole written sort of like class, and it's about 2 episodes every single week there.
Wow.
You know, okay. And there's also like sample essays and tutorials with tips and tricks and stuff like that. So, if any student's got any questions related to the IELTS, feel free to email us. As soon as the student signs up, they get our email address and they can start asking us questions, and we're more than happy to reply. So, yeah. And thank you, Linda, for having me on your show. It's been fantastic.
My pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you for coming.
It's been great.
Yes, we'll include links in the show notes at accepta.com/319 to the website that Ben Worthington just mentioned, as well as to IELTS podcast/sign, where you can sign up for some of those freebies. And I think you also have a YouTube channel that's fantastic. I was exploring it a little bit, and we'll link to that too. Listener, I want to thank you too for joining Ben Worthington and me for our 319th episode. A quick reminder, Master the Paradox at the Heart of Graduate Admissions by downloading our free guide, Fitting In and Standing Out, The Paradox at the Heart of Admissions. Grab your copy at accepta.com/FISO. And a final request, if you find the show worthwhile, please share the good word. Tell your friends. They'll thank you. So do I. And they can find the show at blog.accepted.com/listen. Again, that's blog.accepted.com/listen. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted. And I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.